Yes. Ultimately, the question that is brought up here, of course, is the opportunity that we all have been commenting or talking about, the opportunity at this very juncture of redefining the institutions themselves, the way we think, and the way ultimately we practice as architects or as artists. And this is something that has been of interest to me in the last years. And I could not avoid beginning by an image that was given to me recently by a friend of mine, an artist, Tania Bruguera, who, in her desperation about rethinking the role of art or artistic intervention in the city, she was telling me, I think it is time to restore or to return Duchamp's urinal to the bathroom, she said. And in that, I think she was suggesting a more functional relationship between art and, I would say, architecture to everyday life. And in that sense, I would imagine it also suggests somehow the understanding that the everyday is conditioned, because I will ground the work in a particular practice located on the ground in a neighborhood, particularly located at the border between San Diego and Tijuana, that the everyday is not just an image. Behind the everyday practices that we are all inspired by in searching for a very different conception of economy, participation, and so on, there are procedures that are incredibly intelligent. So the procedures themselves, not the images of the everyday, suggest a very different functional relationship between art and the city eventually. So the other image also that I wanted to begin with, and I'm taking already too much time in beginning with these two gestures that I could not help sharing with you, is the realization, as I was working with some students at the Berlage Institute in Rotterdam, studying the street markets that are located in many neighborhoods in Rotterdam that are almost extinct in a sense, to realize that there is a huge contradiction in terms when we think of economy or neoliberalism or neoconservatism, etc. That while the neoliberal conception or a neoconservative conception, we have to make that distinction because a lot of my students, at least, they think that I'm talking badly about Democrats. The neoconservative conception of economy has benefited only the large, the corporate, has thrived out of deregulation, and as we have seen lately, has thrived out of illegality. While the small street market that has been fundamental to the sustainability of many neighborhoods across the world and many cities, particularly, of course, in the context of where I work, in San Diego and Tijuana, has been defined by repressive regulation, by fear, and by, in fact, the systematic extraction of the possibility that these small markets could be incredibly instrumental in redefining the economy from the bottom up for the sustainability of these neighborhoods and so on. So this contradiction is something that continues to also haunt my mind, because I want to say to these guys, to those guys up there, be consistent. If you want to talk about the entrepreneurial practices that really define really what we call loosely capitalism. So the notion of redefining practice, and I realize that this is particularly an issue for me, that I don't know if you will read these notes, but I wanted to begin with this diagram, particularly to ground the discussion, I think, that you just heard in the context of architectural practice. In my case, it's been essential to realize that my practice in the last 9 years has been defined or inspired by confronting conflict, understanding what the crisis was made of. Because we continue as architects just really dealing with the autonomy of our own field, let's say, in terms of aesthetic and formal relations, but we very seldom talk about what really are the conditions themselves that have produced the crisis. Those conditions could become material for design, the understanding of those mechanics in those operations that have made possible this crisis. This is an unprecedented moment, again, of crisis across the board, from the environmental crisis to housing, you call it, and I cannot, all of them are incredibly long, but the economic crisis being the most dramatic at this moment. The idea that practice and research begin to then be invested in the possibility of exposing conflict as an operational tool. That is the moment of departure for a very, very, very different idea of intervention into the city. This, for me, in my own practice, has been understood as the need to act, let's say, as architects, as translators of much of the dynamics found that are invisible to the institutions, found in neighborhoods and communities of practice across the United States and many other places. The exposure, in other words, of territorial power. Two conditions have defined my need to redefine my own way of doing and thinking. Two things. One, conditions of ownership. Who owns the resources? That has been an essential question for many of the projects that we engage in our practice. Second one, political jurisdiction. Whose territory is it, after all? This is a very important question, as well as in the context of housing and our projects in San Diego, Tijuana. These two conditions of ownership, to understand really what defines ownership in this country particularly, and of political jurisdiction, expose, of course, the dramatic fragmentation of institutions, the dramatic fragmentation of policies, resources, and budgets. This is at the context, again, of planning and the institutions really of urbanization. Then the suggestion that architects in our time, besides designing buildings, we could also design political and economic process that is alternative, that is counter to the recipes that have defined the terms. So in this sense, we could also be designing the redistribution and reorganization of modes of production, of resources within particular communities. This could suggest that we as designers could be producing alternative economic performance outside the ones that have defined the terms in this hyper-privatization of resources and development. Alternative policies that can be inclusive of many other categories of zoning, etc., and alternative spatial tactics that ultimately could frame, in fact, this idea of new socialism in the kind of guidelines or Bill of Rights that we presented today. And finally, I think that this suggests that we need to speak of expanded modes or models of practice in our own fields, that we could facilitate and negotiate new agendas and paradigms, I think, between top-down and bottom-up, between formal and informal economies and urbanization, and between economic capital, or as has been said lately, social capital, which begins to be brought up to the surface. That, for me, then finally ends with this dish, which is the basis of our work, is the possibility to capture the hidden value of the everyday. In other words, the hidden value of informal dynamics in the contemporary city. By the way, I know that maybe there might be a lot of students in the audience. This was an exercise I gave to myself recently in diagramming what the hell we are doing in our office. Who is our audience? Who and why are we doing this? And I think it's an exercise that really helped to clarify what are the issues and how they become the material. Very quickly, I think now I'm not going to be able to go through a couple of the scenarios, but as most of you might know, maybe not, our practice is based in this border territory between the strategies of the informal in Tijuana. I've been interested in understanding the nature of these informal settlements, and on the San Diego side, the conditions of the politics of discriminating zoning and economic models. The straddling between these two places, where, again, in no other place in the world you could find some of the wealthiest real estate, as the one found in the edges of San Diego, barely 20 minutes away from some of the poorest settlements in Latin America. This radical proximity of wealth and poverty, of these enclaves of mega wealth and the rings of social of service communities that are needed to support that wealth. I think that is the relationship that is defining almost every mega city in the world, from Dubai to New York to San Diego. My interest has been in understanding the hidden value of informal dynamics across this formidable barrier between these two cities. Of course, one having to do with the transference of waste from San Diego into Tijuana. So when I have witnessed the recycling of entire bungalows from the older neighborhoods of San Diego brought into Tijuana, or the recycling of waste such as tires into systems that are more efficient, or the garage doors that are transferred en masse from Riverside to Tijuana to construct emergency housing, is a compelling, dramatic image again, but more than an image, it is a political economy of waste that is at play here, and the understanding that at this very sector, of crisis, of conflict, one city is building itself with the waste of the other. So you can imagine that the first ring of suburbanization of San Diego, the levy towns of the 50s, have begun to dismantle themselves, and their waste, their debris, is transferred 20 minutes south to construct the new periphery of Tijuana. Levittown, the U.S. Levittown, is recycled into Tijuana's slums. Now here I just wanted to suggest, because there is no time, that it is the informal economies, densities that are emerging from these slums that are interesting to study, to translate, not because they're about precariousness and the kind of glorification of poverty, but because behind them there is an intelligence that will suggest very different alternative conditions of ownership, of resources, of participation, etc., that equally can be glorified and romanticized, but nevertheless an intelligence that we could translate to inform ourselves better of how to intervene in the city in alternative ways. The flow in opposite direction is people going to California in search for dollars, and much of my work in San Diego particularly has had to do with the impact of immigrants in the retrofitting of older neighborhoods in the U.S. metropolis. In other words, the transformation of the American neighborhood by immigrants, and by this also the interest in redefining our conceptions of citizenship, less defined by the identity package as in terms of nation states, but citizenship having to do with the construction and the production again of space in the city, and immigrants themselves, even though they are illegal, they have been leading the way in rethinking how to think alternatively about economy and about density. So stories that have emerged in our practice that we tend to visualize. I'm interested in the visualization of the invisible to understand what we can extract from that as a series of tactics. In the busiest border in the world, not one single cross-border planning strategy exists. So I decided to put together the two land use maps from the two cities that, of course, do not exist, because San Diego's legislature ends at the border, Tijuana's planning agendas end at the border, so they don't recognize each other. So on one hand, you could put the large swatches of color of San Diego's land use maps, these sort of bedroom communities, sectors of retail dividing themselves, and on the south, you find the high pixelation of mixed use, intensive layering of programs in Tijuana. My suggestion here, in a kind of lyrical way of playing with images, is that this confetti, this high pixelation of use, has begun to infiltrate into this largeness, into this large land use that is discriminated in the last 30, 40 years, depositing itself in many neighborhoods in San Diego. So the alteration of the large with the small. And you can imagine that those older neighborhoods, that first ring of suburbanization in San Diego, looked like a typical Levittown. And the realization, again, out of our research has been, of course, that the homogeneity of these environments has begun to be altered and retrofitted by non-conforming informal economies and densities. I mean, I'm talking about the informal economy plugged into a garage or a granny flat built illegally in the back of a house, etc. This alteration, this urbanism of retrofit that begins to produce alternative modalities of development, including probably the most interesting case story that we have been following, the illegal Buddha, which is this post-war little bungalow that in the last 25 years has been transformed into a Buddhist temple. And in so doing, I think this little house has not been only transformed typologically, but it has transformed the parcel from being the static repository or pedestal of an object surrounded by wasted space into a microeconomic, sociocultural, and pedagogical system. This is a very important issue for our practice, is to suggest that the neighborhood, migrant neighborhoods like the ones found in California, Southern California, can become sites of production of alternative modalities of economy and of sociocultural relations. And in this case, again, how do we begin to understand the transformation of these official large parcels that prevent density and mixed uses, and how they in the last 40 years have transformed incrementally into illegal microeconomic and social systems. So we have begun to map many of these alterations in many of these neighborhoods in collaboration with nonprofit organizations that are grounded, anchored in those neighborhoods, that begin to translate the meaning and the operational value, I would say, of much of this informality into policies and to new performance to suggest new modes of affordability. This is a long story that I would love to really explain more specifically. But mainly what I'm trying to suggest is, again, the issue of challenging our notions of density and of ownership. We continue to perpetuate density as just an amount of units per acre, right? This is the way, the very dry equation, the very abstract, an amount of people per acre. I think the work in observing these neighborhoods, we could produce a very different reading of density. Instead of an amount of units per acre, the density in these neighborhoods is measured as an amount of socioeconomic exchanges per acre, as this Buddhist temple becomes an agency that negotiates and facilitates economic support, pedagogical and cultural support systems into housing. And of course, also the alteration of our very reductive, monocultural and monolithic at times ideas of ownership, as you mentioned. Other conditions of ownership we need to speak of at this moment. This is a piece that speaks conceptually and playfully about the alteration of a Big Mac mansion, okay, in Southern California. The pixelation of the large with the small implies not only the aesthetics of that alteration. A lot of people think that when we talk about our world, we just talk about farmers markets and immigrants, you know, plugging economies in garages, and even though that's the source of our inspiration, ultimately, I think what is at stake here is not the image of that bricolage, but the very tactical possibility of transforming conditions of ownership, as the first thing that will transform in Southern California will be the size of that oil-hungry, selfish urbanization. The large private properties will be pixelated with different conditions of property, but not about owning units, but co-owning the resources that surround those units. It's interesting to imagine that, in fact, the whole economic downturn at this moment in crisis began in this country somehow as people who could not afford to repay those loans were given loans very easily. So I could argue that the American dream has collapsed in conditions of marginality and poverty. It has become, housing has become unsustainable in neighborhoods such as the ones that I work in San Diego. So to rethink ways of producing guarantees as communities become developers themselves of their own housing stock, and the idea that some of these micro properties, private, could become public resources. And as they begin to, again, collaborate and participate, translating the illegality of these actions into actual devices to rethink lending. Because these nonprofits become the translators and the representers of that invisibility. And finally, of course, the redefinition of housing. Do I have 5 more minutes?
Yes.
Has to do with the notion that we as architects need to speak of economy, of course, and I would love to take your seminars, need to understand what the pro forma that defines development means. So the conflict that I have understood as a device in San Diego for some of our projects has been the conflict in the last years between lending and land use. The realization that while downtown became a bubble of wealth, as it became in any city in the United States, with luxury condos dressed with glass facades and stadiums and the franchises that surrounded them, that's the kind of recipe of homogeneity that was exported all over the world. While that was happening in San Diego, not one single affordable housing project was built in many of these neighborhoods in the last years of successful construction boom, aided and supported by low interest rates, and you know the story. The realization then prompted an investigation, as superficial as it might be, to ask why. Why developers are not building in these neighborhoods? Well, because for a private developer, of course, in this country, private developers call the shots. In the absence of a kind of strong investment in public infrastructure and so on, I mean, look at it. We have right now become afraid of the public option. It's incredibly sad. So the developers, really in the last years, the only way to make their operations profitable, to build an affordable housing project in these neighborhoods, these marginal neighborhoods, these developers would have to take advantage of tax credits or subsidies. In this country, tax credits or subsidies are competitive. So to be competitive or ultimately profitable, this project in this neighborhood of housing, of affordable housing, would have to be at least 50 units in density. Well, guess what? 50 units are prohibited by zoning in many of these neighborhoods, creating a catch-22 condition between zoning and lending. Of course, that's the reason we have not seen a lot more investment from the private side in the context of affordability. So for me, it has been important to understand the nature of the top-down recipes of development that have been defined by the notion in this country that only the power of economic capital can be the seed for development, and that the top-down institution of development is defined by an idea that a development, let's say housing, is market-owned. That the market knows better, and we already know what happened to the market. That the economic framework for these housing projects should mean large loans and individual profits. That the political framework that defines these housing projects implies density equals maximum amount of units, minimum investment in public infrastructure, and that the social framework that defines these housing projects is the dweller, the people who live in these projects, are just generic customers. On the other end of the spectrum, we have in many of these neighborhoods where we've been working, the power of social capital. It's a very different idea, of course, that has been operating for decades in the world, but now begins to hopefully resurface, where here the culture and social value can be the seed for development, because here the equation is differently. The housing projects for these communities are neighborhood-owned. They are very specific. I'm arguing right now, maybe as a conclusion, for the specificity of development, as it understands the communities where it enters and how they could participate in producing these projects. That the economic framework behind these projects is microloans and the community profits. That the political framework, the land use, is again density as a maximum amount of social exchanges per acre. And finally, the most naive, but maybe the most compelling to me, is that the social framework for many of these projects that are neighborhood-based is that the dweller of these projects is not a generic customer, but a participant, a co-developer, an entrepreneur that can, with the willingness to participate, allow a very different idea of economic performance. And that it is these negotiations across these transactions where architects can enter to define and conceptualize negotiations and collaborations across communities, across jurisdictions, across institutions, across agencies. These nonprofit organizations can become developers of micropolitics, microeconomics that can redefine our notions of affordability and ultimately representation, I think, and citizenship at large. Thank you.